Foundation.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loria. Coming up today, we're going to talk about how the religion of Christianity swept the world, at least the Roman Empire, in the first 300 or 400 years of Christianity's existence. We're going to talk with Bart Ehrman, who's an historian and a religious scholar. We'll hear about his latest book, The Triumph of Christianity. And later, we'll speak with somebody who's sitting in at the trial of the wife of the Pulse nightclub shooter. There is some amazing news coming out of that trial that's going on right now in Orlando. We'll hear about that news later on in the program. First, six listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we were talking about the big rallies across the country and around the world against gun violence, the March for Our Lives rallies, in which a million people took part. Here's what several listeners had to say.
Colony. Well, first thing I wanted to say was I've been listening all morning, and the kids, I'm listening to their speeches. I shouldn't even call them kids. I'll call them citizens. The young citizens that we've been hearing all morning are amazing. They're inspiring. They're eye-opening, and they're absolutely great orators, and I've just been so inspired all morning. I was there on Saturday for the march, and I just think that I took away from it that my generation, I'm 42 years old, has failed, and we have failed in protecting our children. And this entire concept of business as usual, politics as usual, all falling on deaf ears all the time, they're sick of it. The kids are sick of it. They're sick of hearing us talk and talk and not do anything. And so I'm just so supportive of what they're doing. I'm sorry that we weren't able to make it happen for them. Sorry, emotional, because I have a five-year-old, so it's that feeling of like, whoa. They've got to take this on themselves, and I'm sorry. But anyways, I had a friend comment after the march. She had posted that we were at the march on Facebook, and some of her friends were going to be mad at it. And I said to myself, you know, I'm at a point now where if you believe that there is not a need in this moment for gun reform, then we are on such different pages. And I don't know if keeping friends or not keeping friends on social media is important and not important anymore, because my opinion means saving children. And if yours doesn't, then we're on completely different pages.
Even at St. Pete, I was just listening to the show, and what you said yourself hit me like a sledgehammer. The Trumpsters are hypocritical. Here they are. They want their guns. No one's going to take my guns away against a tyrannical government. We will fight against the United States government. Don't tread on me. However, on the other hand, they want our military to be strong, and they want our National Guard to be strong, right? Now, the Second Amendment, they pervert it. They predicate their right to bear arms on a perversion of the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is for the private militia, or today's standards would be the National Guard, to put down servile insurrection. That's what it's for. So their whole thesis, their whole theory, their whole religion, if you might use that word, their whole doctrine is hypocritical. And let's not forget, there's lefties too that love their guns, and the capitulation of the Democratic Party of not doing anything, because both parties love their guns. And the one caller, Steve in Tampa, I don't think this is going to blow over. The reason the Occupy movement a few years ago got crushed is because Blumberg was threatening to call out the National Guard against these people. And who knows if he would have fired on those folks. So I just wanted to say, Rob, what you said is one of the greatest comments I've ever heard on this issue that gets people thinking about the Trumpster doctrine.
This is Jane from Riverview, and I'd like to make a comment about a subject I've never, ever discussed. That's the problem of just too many people on the planet, too many people in the world. There's lots of people starving and going hungry, and they don't have enough water, and resources are desperately running out, and this is what the whole problem is all about. If there weren't that many people around, there wouldn't be that much suffering either. I know it's just a subject that people just don't want to talk about anymore. They talked about it a lot in the late 70s.
MacArthur over in Lakeland. You were talking yesterday about the NRA I used to be a member of the NRA. When I came home from the service early 1960s, I joined because they seemed to be interested in gun safety and in hunting and that kind of stuff, and was a member for a couple of years. And then one day I get a letter from them, and they say, you know, the right to bear arms is so important that when the early settlers were voting on the amendments for the Bill of Rights, they moved it from number 3 to number 2. And I had never heard that, and I said, I don't think there's any kind of hierarchy in the amendments. So I got a copy of the Constitution and looked, and sure enough, I did some research. It had been number 3 on the ballot as it went around, but number 2 failed. I don't remember what it was about now. But if there was a hierarchy, Amendment 2 then would be higher than number 3, which, no soldier shall be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, and that's going to wipe out Amendment 5, rights in criminal cases, and rights to a fair trial, and all the rest of them. So I just said, that's a stupid lie that's so easily checked. I just do not need to be a member of an organization that does that. And I wrote him a letter and told him that, and never heard from him again. And that's all right with me.
This is Dan. Hey, with the changing economic status that's, you know, currently taking place, mostly affecting poor white folks the most, basically because, you know, in the past they benefited the most in America in the past. A lot of folks, I think, are feeling they've got to hold on to what they've got, whether that's against the gang on the block or the government out to confiscate their guns and stuff. Poor white folks, poor white men feel that they have to protect their family and their homes. Many don't have jobs. They feel like they're losing control. Having an arsenal gives them a sense of power and control of maintaining what's theirs. Basically, they're in a frontier mentality mode. Maybe it was noble in its day, but it's outdated today. To solve the dilemma, we need to get to the root of the problem. The question is, how do we assuage their concerns? How do we help, you know, how do we realize what's the basic concern and work with that and make that reality less true? It may be complicated in our changing social and economic environment, but that, I think, is the real cause of the problem.
This is Ed in St. Pete. In response to the pessimistic caller who claims that this protest over gun violence will be forgotten in a few months, we saw Mothers Against Drunk Driving greatly reduce drunk driving. We saw the Berlin Wall fall. We saw the Soviet Union break up. We saw peace come to Ireland. We saw apartheid end in South Africa. We can reduce gun violence and make the NRA A-plus rating become a scarlet letter.
Well, a lot of people wanted to talk about guns even after yesterday's show. Those are some of the listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. Well, this is a holy week for Christians, and Passover begins this Friday. It's a very holy week for both the members of the Christian faith and for members of the Jewish faith. Christianity could easily have become a forgotten sect of Judaism, but instead it's spread at a mind-boggling pace, converting some 30 million people in just 4 centuries. How did this happen? We're going to talk about that with Bart Ehrman, who is the best-selling author of Misquoting Jesus. He's the author of several other really great books including How Jesus Became God. His new book is The Triumph of Christianity. I spoke with him yesterday about his new book, and this is what he had to say. Bart Ehrman, welcome back to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you to set the scene for us. In terms of the religions at the time of Christ, what were the major religions in the world at the time that Jesus died?
Well, you know, most of the world at the time was pagan. When historians use the term pagan, they don't mean anything negative about it. They simply mean any of the polytheistic religions of antiquity. 93 to 95% of the world was pagan. They worshipped people worshipped many gods. So there wasn't actually a dominant religion or even a group of dominant religions. There were hundreds and thousands of religions around the Roman Empire. They all worshipped many gods, and the gods were worshipped because the gods could provide people with things they couldn't provide for themselves in life. They could provide the rain. They could make sure the crops grew and that the livestock reproduced. They could heal the sick. They could do things that people couldn't do for themselves. And so there are a wide range of religions, all of them polytheistic, worshiping gods for these reasons.
How big was Judaism at the time?
Judaism was the other 5 to 7%. And so the Roman Empire is usually said to be about 60 million people at the time. So there were probably about 4 million Jews in the world.
So the amazing thing about Christianity is it goes from a very small group at the time of Christ's death to how big?
Well, yeah, this is the thing. I mean, after Jesus' death, in the New Testament at least, he's got 11 men disciples left, and he's got a handful of women. These people come to believe in him, so 20 or so lower class, illiterate peasants from a remote part of the empire. Within 400 years, there are something like 30 million of them, so about half of the empire. So the question I deal with in the book is, how do you get from 20 people, especially 20 people like that, to be 30 million? And so, yeah, it's an interesting question.
Let me just back up for a moment and ask you a question I think that you've dealt with in some of your previous books. Did Jesus exist historically, or is he a composite? Do you think that he, as a man, actually existed?
I certainly think he existed, and even though there's a small group of people called mythicists who think that Jesus was a complete myth, in other words, he's just made up, this group has had almost no impact on scholarship because basically the evidence is just so overwhelming that Jesus existed. And I did write a book on this. The book is just called Did Jesus Exist, where I explain what the evidence is that convinces almost everybody about this particular point.
Now, at the time of Jesus' death, was Christianity akin to a cult? How would you describe it at its beginning?
At the very beginning, the followers of Jesus who believed he got raised from the dead thought that he was the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God to the Jewish people in fulfillment of the Jewish law. And so they understood that they were representing a form of Judaism. They would have seen themselves as true Judaism, but it would have been a sect within Judaism. And so if Christianity hadn't changed from that, it would have had the historical significance of other Jewish sects, like the Sadducees or the Essenes, which are important for historians of ancient religion, but they certainly aren't kind of worldwide movements.
Hmm. How did the rabbis, how did the leaders in the Jewish faith, how did they perceive Jesus? If his followers were Jews, was this considered a challenge to mainstream Jewish religion?
Well, I don't think they took it very seriously as a challenge. Most people had never even heard of it. But the reality is that most Jews at the time thought that the Christian claims about Jesus were just ludicrous, because there were people in ancient Judaism who were expecting a future Messiah, but the Messiah was supposed to be a figure of grandeur and power who would destroy the enemies and set up Israel as a sovereign state, ruling the kingdom of Israel from Jerusalem. Jesus was a crucified criminal who was publicly humiliated and tortured to death. So he was just the opposite of what anybody would expect of a Messiah. He wasn't like the Messiah. He's just the opposite of a Messiah. And so when Christians said, "Well, you know, this crucified criminal is actually the Messiah," most Jews just thought that was laughable. And so most of them just didn't take it very seriously.
In your book, The Triumph of Christianity, you challenge two of the main beliefs, or two of the main scholarly beliefs about why Christianity swept the Roman Empire. What are the two main beliefs that you challenge?
Well, the main one is the idea that that Christianity succeeded because the Emperor Constantine became a Christian. And it's certainly true that Constantine did become a Christian. He was the emperor in the early 4th century, And he was emperor during a time when Christianity was being harshly persecuted in parts of the Roman Empire. Constantine converted, and many people have said that that's why Christianity then succeeded, is because everybody jumped on board once the emperor did. What I try to show in the book is that that's probably not correct. It is true he converted, and it is true there are a lot of conversions after his day, but what I show is that given the rate of growth of Christianity at the time, it almost certainly would have taken over the empire anyway, whether Constantine converted or not. If he hadn't converted, then one of his successors probably would have converted, maybe one of his sons, for example. So I don't think that Constantine's conversion is the explanation for why Christianity succeeded, even though it was a hugely significant conversion, because Constantine made Christianity not a persecuted religion, but a most favored religion. And that certainly helped the cause, but it isn't the reason Christianity took over the empire.
Mm. We're talking with Bart Ehrman, and the book is The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World. Okay, so there's no Bible. There's no text, at least not in the way that we have Bibles today. So how were these ideas transferred from person to person? How did they go about selling the idea of Christianity?
Right. It appears not to have been done on the basis of kind of a literary campaign. It's not that they were like floating around copies of the Gospels to convert people or the letters of Paul. We have accounts of people converting, and there are two things to be said about it. One is that it appears to be completely by word of mouth. It's one person converting another person. We have no evidence of evangelistic rallies, of big open-air events where people are doing kind of Billy Graham things and asking people to come forward. There's nothing like that. In fact, there's no organized Christian mission. It's one Christian person converting someone else to the faith. The second thing is they're converting them by convincing them that the Christian God is more powerful than the gods otherwise available in the Roman world. And so they're convincing people by telling them that the Christian God can do greater miracles. He can provide people with the things that they need, and the other gods can't do it.
Well, as a scholar, do you think these miracles really occurred?
I personally don't know. But, you know, the reason most people believe in miracles is because they've heard of miracles. Sometimes people will say they've seen a miracle, but usually somebody will say that their neighbor had a cousin who saw a miracle. So most people believe in miracles because of what they've heard or because of what they've read in the modern world, so that most people think that the miracles of the New Testament happen not because they saw them happen, but just because they read about them. And so I think that's what's happening in the ancient world, is people are telling stories about miracles. And if you tell enough stories, pretty soon people are going to start believing you. And then they'll start telling the stories. And it goes like that for year after year after year.
You also point out in your book, The Triumph of Christianity, that Christianity is a modern religion, or was a modern religion, compared to paganism, in the sense that paganism made superior people dominate inferior people. That's not the best way to put it, but you bring up this topic of domination in your book.
Yeah.
And that Christianity was not a domination religion.
Well, that's right. And, you know, in the ancient world, it wasn't just religion that had this ideology of domination. It was the entire culture. It was simply understood that the powerful were to dominate the weak. That's why there was no ethical problem with a more powerful city or empire to destroy another city or empire and kill its soldiers and to enslave its women and children. And that wasn't seen to be a problem. Or there was no problem that that masters should dominate slaves, and that men should dominate women, and it was a culture of domination. Christians came along and said, no, it shouldn't be domination, it should be love that dictates our actions. So I'm not saying that Christians were more loving than pagans, or that Christians were the only ones saying that you should love, but I am saying that Christians have this ideology that it isn't about domination, it's about service. And that was that was a very different way of understanding how you're supposed to relate to other people.
Now, not every Christian today believes in this idea of service, but you point out in your book that we might not have all these giant charities or, you know, these nonprofits that go out and help people in disasters that are Christian-based, that a lot of these ideas did not exist in the time of Christ's death.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Roman government didn't support charity. They didn't have a welfare system. They didn't. The only reason they took care of the poor is they didn't want riots. But they didn't have hospitals, for example, to take care of the sick. There simply weren't public institutions that were funded with public money and with public initiatives to help the poor and the needy, because they weren't of concern. What was concern of the wealthy and the elite were other wealthy and elite.
We're talking with Bart Ehrman. The book is The Triumph of Christianity, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So at what point did things change in the Roman Empire? So it goes from being a government that resists Christianity to a government that approves of it.
It did, and what I tried to show in the book is that you don't need massive conversions at any one time. What you need is some kind of rate of growth. And so what I try to show is that if you actually think that Christianity grew at about, say, 3% per year, so you've got 100 Christians this year, you get 103 Christians next year. When the 100 of you is 1,000 of you, then it's not 3 converts, it's 30 converts. And if there's 10,000 of you, it's 300 converts. And if it's 100, so you go like that, and after a while, when you've got 1 million or 2 million people, you start having massive converts. And it's because that you're growing at the same rate, or, you know, roughly the same rate, it ebbs and flows, but you grow at a certain rate, and it becomes massive when the numbers start piling in. And the numbers start piling in at the end of the 3rd century. Into the 4th century, and then Christianity basically takes over in the 4th and 5th centuries.
And is that because the emperors and the Roman Empire, instead of resisting Christianity, embraced it?
No, I actually argue in the book that the rate of growth has to slow once the emperors convert, because if it kept going at the rate it was going, there'd be more Christians than there were people in the empire. so that can't be. The reason it's growing like this is because Christianity is the only religion in the pagan world which said that Christians said they were right and that everyone else is wrong, and that if you worshiped the Christian God, you could not worship any other God. There were no other religions that said that. So that if other religions were gaining followers, so the followers of Apollo convert somebody. If you convert somebody to follow Apollo, that doesn't mean they have to stop worshiping Zeus. They continue to worship whatever gods they were worshiping, but now they worship this new god as well. Christians are saying, no, it doesn't work like that. You worship our God, you have to stop worshiping the other gods. So that every time somebody converted to Christianity, they converted away from paganism, and over a few centuries, that means that paganism is losing whenever Christianity wins.
Did these Christian evangelists, these early ones, portray Christianity as a monotheistic religion? Because, you know, paganism was about multiple gods and multiple deities. But Christianity has this problem, and it's got God the Father, it's got God the Son, and it's got the Holy Spirit, all three of which are gods. Did they sell it as a monotheistic religion? And then how did they explain the three, you know, divisions of God?
Yeah, they had it both ways. They absolutely insisted this is a monotheistic religion. And then when people said, well, yeah, well, you've got three gods, they said, no, the three are one. And this is, they develop at the same time that they're spreading exponentially in the 4th century, they're developing the doctrine of the Trinity. That even though there are three divine beings that are distinct from each other, those three are one. And so there's only one God, but he's manifest in three persons, and that's then becomes the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity.
Bart, would you say that early Christians worshiped the same way Christians do today?
No, in fact, I'd say that Christianity today is very different from early Christianity, even though conservative evangelical Christians insist that they're worshiping the way they did and people did in the New Testament times, I'd say it's very different indeed, in all sorts of ways. I mean, in the early centuries, there was no such thing as a church building, for example. Churches were not places, they were groups of people, and people typically worshiped in homes. And they didn't, you know, they obviously didn't have hymnals. They didn't have Bibles. They had certain practices. They were many places a beleaguered minority. In my part of the world, in the American South, I mean, the Christian church is a dominant cultural force. That's completely unlike what was going on in early Christianity, where they would often have to meet in the dark, for example. So it was a very different set of religions from what you see today.
You know, and I imagine the way it was practiced differed because, you know, it's sort of like the game of telephone, where the farther away you get from the source, the more varied the religion becomes.
Well, the earliest Christians, when they were near the source, they were Jews. They continued to practice Judaism. And so they didn't see themselves as a separate religion at all. And that certainly is not the way it is in modern evangelical churches, who see Judaism as a kind of false religion, an unenlightened religion. Whereas the earliest Christians, in fact, continued to worship in Jewish synagogues and going to the temple if they were in Jerusalem and participating in sacrifices. And so it was a very, very different way of expressing their religion.
And was celebrating the Eucharist a common thing in the early days?
It appears to have been. The first author we have is Paul, the first writer we have, and in his letter to 1 Corinthians, he talks about the Lord's Supper, and what he says is very similar to what you find later in the Gospels. So it does appear like this was a common practice to have a weekly meal in which you would remember Jesus' last meal with his disciples.
Bart, I know we're almost out of time. We only have a minute, but I wondered, you have been so prolific and there's so many great books that you've written. I'm wondering, could you describe for our listeners the original sources you go to and the languages that you've mastered in order to get to these kind of histories of religion that you've been writing?
Well, the materials I look at in this book, the primary materials, the original materials, are all written in Greek and Latin, most of them, and there are some other ancient languages. But a scholar of early Christianity has to be able to read a range of languages. Most of my PhD students have to learn Hebrew and Greek and Latin, and sometimes they also learn Coptic, an ancient Egyptian language, or Syriac, and they all have to learn French and German, and some of my research is also in Italian. So, you have to read a lot of languages to be able to do this kind of work.
Well, Bart Ehrman, I wish we had more time. I understand you're working on yet another book, so I look forward to that. What's the next thing you're working on?
I'm working on the question of where the Christian idea of heaven and hell came from. The idea that your soul dies and goes to heaven or hell is not found in the Old Testament, and I'm going to argue that it's not what Jesus himself preached, and so where did it come from?
Bart Ehrman, I can't wait.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Bart Ehrman. Thanks. That was Bart Ehrman, a distinguished professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We were talking there about his new book, The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World. He's also the author of many best-selling books, including Misquoting Jesus. And he is an historian and a religious scholar, as you heard there. Well, if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. In Orlando, a federal judge says the revelation that the Pulse nightclub shooter's father was an FBI informant for many years before the attack has little bearing on the trial that's going on right now of the gunman's widow. The federal judge, Judge Paul Byron, in Orlando yesterday rejected a defense motion for a mistrial of Noor Salman. She's on trial in federal court in Orlando on charges of helping her husband plan his mass shooting at the gay nightclub in Orlando where he killed 49 people in 2016. Salman's lawyers said prosecutors did not disclose that Mateen's father, Sadiq Mateen, was an FBI informant until halfway through the trial. They argued that her right to a fair trial was denied. They also are battling against statements that the young woman made while being questioned by the FBI. Earlier today, I spoke with WMNF True Talk host Ahmed Badir. He's been attending the trial in Orlando, and here's what he had to say about the revelation that the father, the Pulse nightclub gunman, was an FBI informant.
Well, it was somewhat shocking because this all happened in front of the jury yesterday. Was the first day that the defense started putting on their case. The previous 2 weeks or so, the government was putting on their case with their expert witnesses and their testimonies, mainly of law enforcement folks and FBI agents. And then yesterday was the first day that the defense is putting on their witnesses. And one of the witnesses that they called was an FBI agent. And this FBI agent, Agent Martin, has been an FBI agent since 2003, I believe. He's part of something called the Joint Terrorism Task Force out of Miami. And he testified that Omar Mateen's father, Sadiq Mateen, was his informant and was an informant for the FBI undercover from 2005 up until 2016, up until the shooting. So this was a huge revelation in court. And he also testified, the same agent, that at some point in 2013 that the FBI received a complaint about Omar Mateen himself. He was working as an armed security guard at the courthouse in the county that he lived in, and he had made some threats to his coworkers that he worked with. And those threats were something, you know, about that he had connections to jihadists and terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, which, you know, kind of makes no sense because both those groups are enemies to each other, but that's the claims that he was making. And so they had reported him. The FBI opened an investigation, and they sent the same agent who was the handler for his father to investigate the son, which was kind of strange because you think there's some sort of conflict of interest or they should send someone else. So this is the agent that went to investigate, and he testified that he went and interviewed Omar Mateen three times, and all those took place at Omar Mateen's apartment. And at least one or two of those times in the interviews, the father, who's an FBI informant, joined the interview. So now you have, you know, in the interview, the FBI agent that's handling the father, the father, who's an undercover FBI informant, and Omar Mateen. And the agent also said that the father was very upset, or testified. This is all under questioning by the defense. He was upset that the son was being investigated. He often complained to the agent about it. He called him numerous times to tell him about it. But then under questioning, he also, the same agent said that none of that had an impact on his decision or the FBI's decision to close the case.
It raises a conflict of interest question because this is the FBI agent who's running Omar's dad as an FBI informant.
Correct, because, you know, if he angers the dad, he loses that source.
Yeah.
Loses that, you know, so, or he can be easily, you know, persuaded by the father with different explanations, and that's exactly what he's testified, that the father gave different reasons. You know, the agent said specifically that the father characterized the son's comments as he's just being stupid. And that, you know, he was just talking. And the reason he was doing that was because he was being harassed and discriminated against by the other security guards. Apparently, the other security guards that he was working with at the courthouse were oftentimes calling him, you know, racial slurs and accusing him of, you know, different terrorists, you know, like calling him Osama bin Laden, or I'm not sure exactly what the phrases are, but that was a justification. Now, it went a step further that this same agent said, because the defense was asking, well, why did you have to go visit him three times? You did question him the first time, the second time. Why are you repeatedly going to see, you know, to see him? And he testified that one of those reasons was that he was interested. This is the FBI agent who was handling the father. He was interested in recruiting Omar Mateen.
The FBI was interested in recruiting the eventual Pulse nightclub shooter as an informant?
Yes, and during that testimony, the jury's eyes were just opened up. There was gasps in the room because, you know, he could be a good source for them. And they asked him, well, why didn't you pursue it? He said, well, something else changed for him at work, and he was no longer handling that area. It wasn't really clear exactly why, but it was not because they saw him to be a threat. In fact, they closed the investigation on Omar Mateen. They allowed him to continue to be a security guard. They notified the sheriff's office that he was safe. In fact, there's an email out there where the sheriff deputy himself, or the sergeant that was overseeing this, sent an email to his colleagues saying that he spoke to the special agent in charge of the FBI. I think his last name was Glass. And that special agent in charge of the FBI in the Miami Bureau notified the sheriff that Omar Mateen was not connected to terrorism and, quote, we don't think he's going to go postal or anything like that, end quote.
Wow.
2 years later, within less than 2 years later, Omar Mateen did go postal and kill 49 innocent people in a tragic attack.
I want to ask one more question about Omar Mateen's father, Sadiq, who was an FBI informant for those 10 or 11 years. Testimony came out that he was sending money to Turkey and other countries in the Middle East, and that he was possibly involved in some sort of attack on the Pakistan government. Could you describe what the testimony was?
Yes, they said that the father, they had received some anonymous tip that the father was sending this money overseas. So while he was being an informant, there was an accusation against him that he was raising money in America somewhere between $50,000 to $100,000, and he was doing wire transfers to Afghanistan, his native country, and Afghanistan and Turkey. They didn't get into too much detail about what's the nature of that. Again, this was only a notification. The defense found out about all of this on Saturday. Imagine the trial had already started. There's a certain, during discovery phase, there's certain rules that dictate what the prosecution is supposed to turn over and when to the defense. So a defendant has a reasonable chance to defend themselves. The government is not allowed to withhold information, especially information that would exonerate or would have an impact on the defendant being able to provide different theories. So the defense was complaining to the judge saying, well, had we known this stuff ahead of time, we would have been able to investigate other theories of defense. Like, we weren't even looking or considering that the father may be somehow involved, but it looks like the father of Omar Mateen was a lot more involved than anything that Nur Salman ever did because of, you know, his statements and his activities and the money and intervening on behalf of his son. He knew a lot more about his son's behavior. It wasn't really clear, but the investigation was that the father was sending that money overseas to somehow fund some violent attacks against the Pakistan government.
So none of this is revealed before the trial, and the defense is saying that this is a violation of the rules, the rules of having a trial, that the federal government did not reveal this during the discovery phase before the trial.
Right. They're saying there's prosecution misconduct here, and they're violating something called the Brady violation, which, you know, says that you have to turn over this evidence. And this is not the first thing. On Thursday, there was another huge thing that the judge himself was very upset about, that he felt that he was misled by the prosecution. On Thursday, another FBI agent testified on the stand, and this was the last Thursday, that within days of the Pulse nightclub shooting, the FBI discovered that it was impossible for Omar Mateen and his wife, Nur Salman, to do what's called casing the Pulse nightclub, something that which was an essential part of the allegation against Nur Salman. Is they're saying a huge part of the evidence against her is that she assisted her husband in selecting the Pulse nightclub, and they went and cased it by driving around it some like a week or so before the attack took place. All of this is based on three statements that Nur Salman allegedly made to the FBI. Now, these statements are not recorded. There's no audio or video recording. And they're written in the handwriting of the FBI agent, who was the only one in the room with Nur Salman when it took place. So there's no other witnesses. There's just that one FBI agent named Enriquez, who was a polygrapher, and rather than administering the polygraph, ended up writing these statements. His excuse was, well, she told me to, she'll dictate and I'll write down the statements. In those statements, she says that her and her husband cased the Pulse nightclub. Well, within days of the shooting, the FBI determined that it was impossible. There was no evidence. There's no GPS evidence. There's no forensic evidence. In fact, her and her husband's GPS coordinates with their phones showed them to be too far away to ever make it to the Pulse nightclub. But despite knowing that within a few days, they charged Nur Salman 8 months later after the, you know, the shooting took place, because Nur Salman was not charged immediately. She was charged 8 months later, and they charged her using the same evidence of the casing that they knew to be false.
Mm. Could you describe Nur Salman? She's the woman who's on trial, the wife of Omar Mateen, the Pulse nightclub shooter, but she's now on trial for, the federal government says, withholding evidence or withholding information about her husband's intention to shoot
she's
up.
She's actually on trial for something called aiding and abetting and obstruction of justice. And the aiding and abetting part is not only that they're not alleging the only knew, and the judge made it very clear that in order to violate this law that they're charging her with, she not only had to have known, she had to have assisted and aided his attack. And there's no evidence in so far in the government's case that she did any steps to, you know, real steps to actually aid him. She didn't go with him to the nightclub. She didn't shoot him. She didn't drive the, you know, a car to get him there. I mean, there's no hard evidence. It's all based on a statement that she made to them in the same day. They picked her up while Omar Mateen was still in the nightclub during the shooting. You know, he went in at 2 a.m., was not killed until 5:30. They picked her up around 4:30 a.m. She didn't know what was going on, and they kept her from 4:30 a.m. until midnight the next day, and interrogating her. And then they say basically she made these statements that are incriminating.
All right, so I want to ask you about her. The only word I have for it is intelligence level. Is she easily impressionable? What's her IQ? What does the defense say about this woman who is on trial, Nur Salman?
The defense has already stated that due to us, you know, after a psychiatric evaluation, her IQ is 84, which is in the, you know, bottom 20 percentile of the country. She has something called the suggestibility rating of like 98-99%, meaning if you tell her something enough, she'll just adopt it and believe it. And that many people, including government witnesses themselves, on cross-examination testified that she's like a child. Mm. She's not very smart. And it's kind of awkward because they don't want to say she's not, you know, she's not smart or that she's, you know, dumb. They, you know, they find other words like she's not good with math. She can't, you know, keep any jobs. She was in special education schools and classes her whole life from kindergarten until she graduated from high school. You know, she was never able to, you know, to be in the regular classes. So she had to go to, schools for students with special needs. That's like students who have autism, other special needs, and, the government keeps pointing to some sort of associate degree that she apparently received later in the medical field, but she got it from one of those colleges that they keep, you know, leaving out, that one of these colleges are now shut down because there was basically a diploma mill.
Those for-profit predatory schools
that have now been shut down by the government.
So the federal government is saying, though, on their side, they're saying that she's a manipulator and she's planned this out and thought this through.
They're saying she's so smart that she's a mastermind behind this, and that she somehow, because Omar Mateen that night was invited, her and Omar were invited to an important dinner at the local mosque, and that she came up with a cover story that she instructed Omar Mateen to tell his parents so somehow he can go out and carry out this murder, as if someone who's going to go out and kill 49 people needs a cover story to get out of a dinner date with the parents. And furthermore, they're saying that text messages that were exchanged between her and her husband. While the husband was inside the club, she was not aware that he was inside the club. He told her that night before he left that he's going out with his friend Nemo, and that's it. She assumed that he's with him. And then when it got late, his mom started calling her, asking where he was. She started calling her husband to find out where he is. She calls him. He doesn't answer. She texts him asking, where are you? Where are you? He responds, is everything okay? He's now inside the club. She doesn't know he's in the club. And then she responds and says, your mom is very worried about you. You promised her that you're going to swing by her house, and you haven't. And now it's very late. And by the way, you have work early tomorrow morning. You need to get home. And then he replies and says, haven't you seen what happened? And then she replies to him and says, seen what? What happened? What happened? She keeps sending question marks. And then his final message was, I love you, babe. Well, from the text messages, it sounds like somebody that doesn't know what's going on. The government is saying that all those text messages are pre-planned text messages that she sent to him to cover her own tracks, to appear that she doesn't know what's going on, that she's in the dark. But really, this is a way to manipulate and mislead the government, from it all. And so that's what they're trying to allege, that somehow she was so smart to carry out all these things. And then the government, the defense pointed out that, well, is there any evidence that when he told her, haven't you seen what happened? Is there any evidence that night at all that if she knew what was going on? What was she doing on her computer? Because we're not able to read minds nowadays, but everybody goes to their phones, they go to their computer, they're always Googling things. So even though after her husband said, haven't you seen what happened, there's no evidence at all that she went on her computer or on her phone to search anything about a shooting in downtown Orlando or anything like that. What did they show her doing that night before she went to sleep? She was shopping online. Mm-hmm. She was like shopping for, jackets and reading like romance novels. That's what she was doing on her computer.
Ahmed, we're up against the clock. I want to ask you about one more bit of testimony, and that is that there was testimony on behalf of the defense this week that the Pulse nightclub was not the original target of Omar Mateen, that it was an afterthought. This is based on cell phone records and the way they're able to track where your cell phone is. Could you describe why the defense thinks that Omar Mateen attacked Pulse as an afterthought?
Well, this is something that now it has come out in the trial. Not only the defense agrees, but the is pushing this theory, but also the prosecution is in agreement that he was not going out to attack gay people. And that's not central to their argument anymore, which is much different than, what we were led to believe since the Pulse nightclub shooting. And the reason they're saying this is because when Omar Mateen left, because now, you have forensic, wherever your phone is basically your data. And something that's shocking, throughout this trial is how much information they're able to get from your phone, even, after you're not around anymore. It tells you so much about a person. So they knew exactly, minute by minute, where Omar Mateen went when he left the house. And he went to Disney Springs. Disney Springs is like an entertainment area in the Disney area. And he's seen on with his phone there, GPS coordinates, cell towers, his GPS on his phone, it tracked him to be there. But he's also seen on footage of Disney itself. They have cameras.
Did he appear to be casing Disney Springs?
Well, he's going there. He's walking around. Yeah, he appears to be casing. And he just, went in and he's by himself. And he went looked like he was buying something and he was walking around. And the theory is that he abandoned the idea to attack Disney Springs because there was too many police. And you can see on the cameras there's so many sheriff deputies there that he left. What did he do? He went to his car, and then he Googled, because they have his phone. They know exactly what he did, why he was there. And he Googled from the parking lot, Orlando nightclubs or downtown Orlando nightclub. He didn't Google Pulse. He didn't Google gay clubs. He just Googled downtown nightclubs. And then the first one that came up was Club Eve. He went to this club called Club Eve. He drove it. It shows him. They even had it where they're playing in the courtroom. Navigation audio, turn right, turn left in 500 feet, turn, left on Orange. And then eventually he gets to Club Eve. And they show him standing how long he was outside Club Eve. And Club Eve is in a very busy area of downtown Orlando. And again, it had a lot of police presence. They were doing pat downs. They had security guards at the door, multiple officers. And he drove away from Club Eve. Or while he was at Club Eve, he Googled again downtown nightclubs. And it shows that he doesn't know where he's going. This is not somebody that's familiar with downtown Orlando. If you did the casing, you already know where you're going exactly. And he's driving around and he's going back and forth and keeps changing and Googling until he goes to drives by Pulse. And he hesitates. You can tell that he hesitates because he drove by and then put some other coordinates and drove away from Pulse for a while, but then eventually made a U-turn and came back to Pulse, pulled up, and the defense is basically suggesting that he went to Pulse because it had the least amount of security and possibly no security, and he walked right in.
All right.
So why did he attack Pulse? Is because it didn't have the security, and he started shooting people. So it wasn't necessarily, and some have even argued that he didn't even know he's in a gay nightclub when he started shooting.
So it, at least the defense is saying it's more of a crime of opportunity, not a crime of long-standing intent. Ahmed, I just got to ask you quickly, why are you there? Why are you attending the trial?
Well, I've been a long-time civil rights advocate, and I see that there is, you know, potentially an injustice happening here. So I want to make sure that the right story is out there. And, you know, Noor Salman happens to be a Muslim. I don't like to see double standards applied when it comes to Muslims. I'm surprised because, you know, there's mass shootings that happen all the time in this country, unfortunately. But they don't drag the family members of the mass shooters in court and punish them for the crime of the mass shooter. It didn't happen in Las Vegas. It didn't happen in Parkland. It's not happening in other places. And I feel like there is, you know, something else that's going on here. And, you know, the defense is trying to say that, you know, they're trying to cover their tracks. This was embarrassing that the son of their FBI, of their own informant, killed 49 people. So how well is this, you know, informant program, which has been very controversial within our community, working out? It's not making us any safer if the son of your informant for 11 years goes out and kills 49 people and then you hide it for this entire time. This is a huge failure, and I hope after all of this is done, there's a huge investigation. Maybe the inspector general can look into how something like this could happen, because oftentimes law enforcement looks the other way when their informants do bad things. You know, they turn a blind eye, so that can be very dangerous.
And I'm sorry we're out of time, but Ahmed Badir, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF and speaking about the trial of Noor Salman.
Thank you so much.
Ahmed Badir is the co-host of True Talk here on WMNF, and he's been attending the trial in Orlando. The latest news on this, Sean Canan from the newsroom says that the defense is resting, and just reading from the Orlando Sentinel, Noor Salman's defense rested its case Monday in the trial of Pulse gunman Omar Mateen's widow after calling an expert who testified that Salman is very vulnerable and at much higher risk than the average person to give a false confession. Dr. Bruce Frumpkin, a South Florida-based forensic psychologist, testified that Salman testified in the, or tested rather, in the lower 14th percentile for intelligence and is more submissive than 90% of people. Salman, he said, is really extreme, particularly under pressure in yielding to misleading information. So that's from the Orlando Sentinel. Scott, who's in Holiday, who made a $10 contribution to WMNF during these interviews. John says the discussion of the prosecution's actions and misdeeds are not a surprise by federal prosecutors. John writes the Bundy trials in Oregon and Nevada fell apart because of a lot of chicanery that federal agents and investigators used, writes John. And let's take maybe a quick phone call. Andy Andrews in Hardy County. Andrew, we just have about 30 seconds. What would you like to say? Andrew in Hardy County. All right. Well, he's been holding for a while. Andrew, sorry about that, but we would have liked to have gotten you on, but weren't able to do it. And David writes this regarding the first interview with Bart Ehrman. He says, I was thinking that the early evangelists probably had a hard time convincing people that Jesus rose from the dead. When the early evangelist said that the stone was rolled back and Jesus was gone, I bet people said, yeah, right, whatever, writes David. All right, David's they're kind of quirky. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 or record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at the start of the show. Midpoint with your hero, Mark Bureau, is coming up in the next hour. But first, we're going to hear the NPR news in just about a minute. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg.
I'll show you a young man with many reasons why. And there but for fortune may go you or I. Show me an alley, show me a train, show me a hobo who sleeps out in the rain. And I'll show you a young man with many reasons why. And there but for fortune may go you all right.